Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcon, Slumber Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
What's up?
And freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
I am back.
He is.
Good to have you back for the second half of our Sydney Film Festival coverage. We covered Cornell Aussie's Owl Law last week. You can hear our chat up on podcast and on 2SCR. And we are talking more things Sydney Film Festival in this episode. It's ongoing until June 21st. We were talking specifically about three films we caught, Sea Fever, Charter, and Kids Run, which you can catch now that are streaming. First, we want to talk about some of the things that are happening about town, including the big news of the day is that of July 1st, with social distancing measures, cinemas, they're reopening. Some are reopening the following week. I know the Ritz and the Orpheum are opening. So the Orpheum is opening up from the following week, but July 1st, cinemas can reopen.
Yeah, and the Ritz will be having, about a week after reopening, a big Fellini retrospective with eight films by the master, not including maybe my two favorites, A Vitelloni and Knights of Cabiria, but basically all the other major Fellini films through different phases of his career are represented. That'll be a treat. Great way to welcome us back to the glorious Church of Light, whatever pretentious phrase I can sum up for cinemas. I love cinemas.
My third favorite Fellini film, La Dolce Vita, turns 60 this week.
So I think that's why they've...
No, it's his 100th birthday.
Ah, wow. Well, yeah, it's the Cinema Reborn crew. We're going to include this retrospective as part of their festival this year, which was cancelled. Instead, you at least get to enjoy the Fellini retrospective at the Ritz.
It's nice that we don't have films in a respect that... Because major studios aren't Tenet, like we predicted. And instead of showing Labyrinth and other big 80s movies, which are great, no, let's go back. Let's watch some classics you wouldn't otherwise see on the big screen.
Yeah, unless I've missed something, Tenet is still coming out just 2 weeks later. It's now set for around August.
31st of July, I think?
Yeah, 31st of July.
31st of July, all right. A little bit of delay. We'll see how long that stands. We hope it does come out because we do really want to cover it.
Yeah, I think they'll be keeping an eye on how many people go to the cinemas upon reopening to decide whether they stick to that date or push it back to maybe when people are less afraid of being in enclosed air-conditioned spaces.
Especially if they can't go with a bunch of people
around
a full crowd for
yeah.
a big budget movie.
Yeah. No, I think Christopher Nolan has enough of a push that people will still come out and watch a Christopher Nolan movie. It's just that because of restrictions, it'll be like, if you're forced to only have a capacity of, let's say, 50%, then yeah, I think the producers will take a loss, and I think that will just basically factor into.
It really depends, I think, also on how long the extended release of this film is going to go for, because they were talking earlier about Tenet potentially sticking around much longer than films usually do and playing for months. Months and months and months. It could be playing for a year before they release it on video.
Parasite's been playing for a better part of a year, so...
Right.
I mean, they even had a black and white version of Parasite, which...
Which no one saw, and why?
I don't know,
If Tenet is good enough, that it's an interesting strategy. Like, the film just keeps going in cinemas, and eventually you're going to go and see it.
Much like the central premise of the film, right?
Played at the Orpheum for 6 months.
Oh yeah, as it is in heaven.
As it is in heaven, it's going to be that in my Big Fat Greek Wedding for action movie junkies like ourselves. Speaking of Parasite and Oscar-winning movies, in today's episode of Oscars Be Dumb, the Academy Awards have postponed not only their ceremony till April 25th, which is fine, but I think for the first time in history, they've actually expanded the 12-month period by which films for this year's ceremony is eligible to 14 months till April.
So when is the ceremony actually going to be held?
April 25th, Anzac Day.
Huh. Okay. Me and Glenn discussed this a little bit before the show started recording. We're both on the page that this is a move to appease the studio executives. They don't want to throw a bone to Netflix and give them all the nominations. I think they realize that a lot of the Oscar bait type films were going into production only around the beginning of this year. They have a shorter post-production time than the big summer blockbusters. They wouldn't be ready on time.
But major studios, in most respects, had opportunities to release these films on other platforms. They could have, they chose not to. And that's to their detriment if they're not eligible for the Oscars or other award ceremonies. The Oscars have thrown them a massive bone, and it's not fair to the other films who went ahead and took a risk and have issued their films out now or will do so in the near future.
But I'm thinking, is Oscar bait, especially for next year, as big an incentive as it is in previous years, because I think the world that we're living in is mostly about how do you minimize losses and yet release your films in a manner that you can recover costs rather than just become an award-spade kind of scenario.
Going to streaming, unless Netflix is going to throw you a ton of money, which they won't, is a loss.
Yes.
It basically, exactly. If all these films, if some of these are $100 million grosses potentially, and they all go to streaming instead, that's just a write-off for the studios.
I mean, so no amount of Academy Awards, 10, 12, or 20, is going to make up for that kind of a bottom line hit.
Exactly, honest. Yeah. I think the studio, I think they should have just sucked it in. I think the Oscars should have said, tough, it's a strange year. We're going to nominate some different kind of award films this year. It would have been much more interesting.
Oh yeah,
Invisible Man, baby. Yeah, it's all tied in with the whole business side of Hollywood, and they've got to keep those investors happy.
So that is our late weekly installment of Oscars being Oscars and doing terrible Oscar things. Ah, now we don't have to talk about it till April, guys. Woohoo! Now. Talking about things that are happening in town this week, of course, the Sydney Film Festival is in full swing until the 21st. You can purchase a full festival pass, 200, or purchase its fastest individual strands or films. Also online is the St. Kilda Film Festival out of Melbourne, which is accessible throughout the country for the first time, which is screening shorts. The Cinema and Science Fiction International, Science International Film Festival, excuse me, is online now. The drive-in theatre that has popped up in addition to Sydney's Blacktown Drive-In Theatre, Move In Car From Move In Bed, is screening over at Moore Park. And the Static Vision are going into their 12th week of screenings on this Friday night. Universal announced the second now online iteration of the Hyperlinks Festival, which will be taking place from June 10th to 12th. Monster Fest is also having an event in their second weekly series on 9 p.m. on Friday night, which is a Facebook watch party. And also on Friday night, PAX night, is the Human Rights, Arts, and Film Festival are doing one of their regular online screenings. So those are all events you can catch in the next week. But for now, we are talking Sydney Film Festival. Let us know what you're watching, because there's a lot of stuff that's streaming online. We picked three films, three very different ones, at least ones we thought were very different.
They're all from the Europe Voices of Women in Film strand, which is one of the only strands of the festival and the only one that has narrative features.
Yes. And we picked films from Germany, Ireland, and Sweden, though the Irish one is an Irish-Swedish co-production. And we're going to start with the German film, which is also a German language film, but partially in Russian as well, which is Kids Run. It's from director Barbara Ott and stars Yanis Nirwathner. Excuse me if I mispronounced any of the names here. And I understand he's actually a bit of does some like fantasy fun comedy stuff in Germany. So
this is a big change for him.
Big change from, I think I haven't seen his work before. He is quite a well-known face within Germany. It is a story of amateur boxer, played by Neil Wachner, who is a father of three and struggling to make ends meet. He has three children, two different women, both of whom in different respects he is estranged from. And it's just trying to hold down a regular job and see his children. He's trying to make ends meet so he can have a regular life and have a regular apartment for them to come back to. He is some months behind in the rent, and like many others in films we have seen before, takes the boxing route. For me, in almost all respects, we'll get to the ending a little bit later, this is a lot of boxing by the numbers. We've seen boxing films come out as metaphors for struggle and aspiration every year. And while there's some things that are different about this, this is the latest in a long, long line.
Yeah, it's kind of a film festival filler film, I think, because it's mostly going to play around the world at festivals and it's not going to stand out beyond them because I'm a boxer and this is my last shot at redemption stories are really by the numbers. And this is, though leaning a little bit more into the grimy film festival, social realism, bleakness, this is essentially just another one of those. But it's a by-the-numbers, bleak film festival, social issues, drama, and it's a by-the-numbers, boxing,
universal story. You can set this almost anywhere. There isn't anything too particularly distinct to its setting.
But I didn't find it terrible. I thought it was, I thought it was engaging enough. I thought the characters were all fairly consistent and believable in the way they acted, with maybe a few minor exceptions towards the end, but it didn't jar me. It felt like it was well thought through. The main thing that I took away from it is how good Nirwathner is. I thought he was a really strong lead. I thought he made this kind of, you know, strong, masculine, inexpressive character while revealing the kind of underlying depths and contradictions. He was really, really good.
He was. I think one of the things that actually made this film a lot more bearable for me was his performance. Mm-hmm. Given that, you know, we've seen a lot of those boxer type performances over the years, but it's interesting when, you know, that they're all hearts of gold, but he, for this one, actually inhabited that boxer persona, and it was shown through a lot of his interactions with people, including his kids. And that was the more interesting bit. Like, when he would interact with his kids, he was a lot more rough and unrefined in his interactions with them, like an actual boxer would be. Rather than, you know, because usually you have the Stallone version, which is like, I'm a boxer in the ring, but really kind-hearted, you know, sweetheart when you're talking to his family and kids. And I'm like, these are two different people. Whereas here, there's more consistency in his character to actually convince you that he's a boxer through and through.
I felt he was really good. I felt in particular, I'm going to make a similar comment about the next one we're going to talk about too. The two children, the child actors, were really good, especially the young woman, his eldest child, who probably has one of the strongest arcs throughout the film. As a boxer also, it frustrates me to a great extent how in a lot of boxing films, people don't either have the physical build for a boxer or... and this, he does. I don't think
he totally does.
Heavyweight division. He's 89 kilograms and he wouldn't compete in that weight class, but he...
You could buy him as like a midweight kind of guy. He's a big dude.
He's a big dude, yeah.
I was terrified.
But having said that, his physique and the boxing scenes were relatively well done and relatively realistic compared to a lot of boxing fare. Having said that,
I totally agree with
weight class. I think it's unlikely that this particular person would, however, that the film does address this in part.
I totally agree with what Virat was saying about the way that he interacts with people, though. He's built around being stoic and bearing punches. Like, that is the kind of way he relates to the world. And he is a little bit rough with his kids without being physically abusive.
Yeah, but it was still actually a bit disconcerting to watch. Because you
it is, because he's
films.
He's edging on that line
where
it's so, like, is this guy actually going to one day snap and become violent?
Exactly.
Where you wonder that because you can see that he has the potential to, but he's restraining a lot.
Yeah, because you see it in the scene with the kitten, which you're not going to ruin. I read a review which harshly criticized Simone. I actually think it was very hard to watch, but I think it was actually one of the best scenes in the film because it spoke to his state of mind and spoke to where he was, and it spoke to his sense of extremeness and desperation.
And it's also, it's a character that keeps making mistakes and trying to make other people pay for them and is fighting to try and prove himself.
I think would also come up in the other film that we're going to talk about is the fact that how the major characters in these movies seem to somehow not take responsibility for their actions and just think everyone else is at fault instead of realizing that if they just did the right thing, this movie would not even have to be made, to be honest, if they just realized their mistake in the first 5 minutes.
Well,
Well,
that speaks to his arc. And on that, with boxing films, the Rocky series is basically the coda for almost every boxing film, and very few find a way to move too greatly beyond how one of those films transpires. This has, I'm not going to ruin the ending, but this has a moment which is akin to a key moment in Rocky Balboa, but it actually goes on quite a different tangent. It's something that happens in the final act of this film in the course of the boxing sequences, which is distinct from what I've seen from a lot of boxing movies. It is original as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and I thought it was right for this story.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, to the film's greatest credit, that and the young actress who played his eldest daughter.
There are definitely credits to the film. It's just not distinct enough overall.
No.
And also, I had major problems with the arc of his ex-girlfriend and basically how it just gets resolved, essentially without actually ever having a justification, given that much time is paid to the fact that she wants something distinct out of her life. Hmm. And then how that arc is resolved was just a major...
It was rushed and it was inconsistent, and we needed more time to explore what was going on there.
Yeah, they wanted a certain note for the film to end on, and it didn't earn it. And it goes back to the matter of, if your films be good, consequences need to happen to characters and need to play out in full, and that tangent it didn't.
The one other good thing that I liked about the film was actually how lived in it was in terms of its social milieu. So you can see how difficult it is to break the cycle of poverty, which is what a lot of boxing films allude to, but they are not actually able to depict quite clearly. But this was, you could see from the environment that he was a part of that he could not find and move beyond his social class and mobility because of certain factors. And those factors are clearly fleshed out. And the fact that he was struggling to actually, you know, move beyond it. So living day to day and having that poverty cycle and breaking through that was actually such a big part of the situation he found himself in.
Yeah, the and first that Rocky kind of felt standard for this.
I know, but still, it's interesting to see how that mirrored the boxing metaphor. And even though that's been played, I thought it was an interesting task to bring in the oppression of social pressures as like an actual, you know, an actual punch or an uppercut to your kind of morale and your boosting kind of thing. And he felt
even so, that's this kind of like
you're fighting on every front,
masculine poetry about the every man. It's definitely been done.
Yeah, but it did feel a bit like, you know, the Ken Loach kind of story of Mr.
Oh, yeah, it totally is. Or Darden Brothers. Yeah.
But I'm glad that those were more poetic touches, because otherwise I was feeling like I've seen everything. But I'm glad it borrowed in bits and pieces and then put its own twist to it. It still didn't make sure that there was not a completely distinct identity, but still it was different enough to not make me completely hate it. Like, otherwise I would be rolling my eyes in 30 minutes in. But I sat through all of it, and it wasn't completely unbearable.
There was enough distinct... I give it more credit than that. There was enough distinct for me to enjoy it as a film. However, there wasn't so much that was original or certainly unique to it that I was found it especially memorable.
It was decent, but it's hard to recommend for that reason.
Yeah.
So that is Kids Run. The next film we're chatting about...
Charter.
Charter. Maybe there's a particular context to the name in that people of Swedish background in Sweden might be aware of. I'm not.
I didn't understand the title.
Yeah. I didn't understand the title.
Maybe it is about like uncharted territory or whatever. Charted.
I didn't quite take that from it. Okay. Charter is a film from Amanda Connell starring Anne Del Torp. Again, excuse me if I've mispronounced her name. About a mother who is in the midst of a quite a bitter custody battle with her former husband over their two children, and decides at a point that it's going to reach a crux to take her two children on a trip to, I think it's the Canary Islands, and the film
Island of Tenerife. Yeah.
Tenerife. Yeah. And
yeah. If anyone who saw the Whistlers last year, this is, yes, I think, a neighboring island to La Gomera.
And we get a reference to that. The
Whistling
language.
The Whistling language.
Yep.
Yes. So I never made the connection. We do.
What? That was the first thing.
Well, no, I remember the Whistling language. I just didn't realize it was the same.
It is, yeah.
Geographic setting.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And the tension between her ex-husband, her two children, and personally the authorities and else that is looming over her and their heads. Again, this is a story which is universal, and we've seen play out in many different films, many different contexts. We see films like this come regularly on the festival scene. I'll make a similar comment as I did the previous film, that the main actress, the main performer is very good. The two child actors, and especially the elder lead, are also very talented. I enjoyed it for that. And I'll get to a couple of individual scenes that I quite enjoyed and quite liked, but there isn't too much of this distinct about this either to stand out beyond what would be a general festival crop.
Can I say that this was, for me, just like generic film festival sludge? I thought this was actually just pretty awful. I thought it was so contrived. There's one scene in particular that I'm going to have to pick apart later on just to point out how manipulative.
Is it the karaoke scene?
No, though that was pretty bad.
No,
it's the club
no.
scene later on.
Yes, yeah.
I'll get to that. But I was thinking that this whole scenario and the twists and turns feel contrived and artificial all throughout the film. And then there's this one moment that just encapsulates everything I was hating about the movie. But we'll get to that. Just on a more general level.
I think first of all, please can we stop using mental illness as such a big crutch for everything? And I think this movie just does it so badly. And there'd be movies that have done it incredibly sensitively and well, like Leave No Trace, for example, recently, which is also in the top 40 Sydney Film Festival picks that you can watch.
Yeah, you should go see that.
Better example of how to use mental illness if you're going to go down that path. But this film is so incredible. It uses terms like psychosis and psychotic in a way without...
All right. Yeah. I want to respond directly to that. That is an interpretation. It's a fair interpretation. I think it is debatable to an extent. What I do like about this film is that it leaves a lot open to interpretation in terms of her, whether to what extent she is a reliable narrator.
It's funny that that's the strength of the film to you, because for me, that was a peek at the better film that it could have been. Like, I saw what they were doing with this ambiguity where it goes between, oh, is she righteous, doing the right thing when there's a world that is just set up against her because of inequality or whatever, versus like, oh, is she's breaking the law and maybe people don't trust her for a reason. That idea is interesting, but there's a point where I think you have to resolve some of these ambiguities in order to progress the story and progress the themes of the narrative. And this film, I think, was afraid to do that. The ambiguities are interesting, but it didn't lean hard enough into that kind of mystery to make it really interesting. And at a certain point, I wanted to see stuff resolved. I'll give you an example. It seems like she might just be, from some of the things that are being said and implied, a chaotically mentally ill person, right? But from what do we know about her early on? She seems to be a surgeon. Like, if she was really that chaotic that she couldn't have any kind of structure or rigidity in her life at all, would she be able to be a surgeon? I don't think so. The whole thing just felt artificial to me and contradictory.
I think more than that, I feel we needed some grounding.
We do.
Context as to the nature of the marriage breakup. And I appreciate this is entirely relevant, even though it is relevant to some extent. But I think we need a little bit more of that for it not just to be open to interpretation, but for us to make a succinct judgment call. I think I agree that I appreciate this ambiguity in that we can have discussions like this, but I would like to be a little more confident in the calls I can make about this character in this film, and that those bits are left a little too open.
I agree.
I think I can kind of see what they were going for in terms of, like, you're never quite sure whose side or who's, you know, it's a Rashomon effect about, you know, you're never quite sure which version of the story you're supposed to believe, whether it is her ex-husband or her point of view, because there's always this kind of supposed tension as if, like, you know, are the kids actually safe, and who are they safer with? In terms of, because there's this back and forth.
Or neither, another fair interpretation.
Exactly. Yeah. But unfortunately, there's never enough background laid for us to invest in either of these characters for me to really understand whose perspective I'm supposed to really somewhat see through, because the character grounding is so faint.
Well, I think it's easy to create mystery through interpretation, through ambiguity and leaving everything open to interpretation, but there's a point where you need, it's better and necessary to fill in with interesting details. And I think this was unable to do that. Like, there was a point where the ambiguity, I think, was actually getting in the way of the narrative, because it felt like if the characters would start talking about some of these issues, some of the problems between the characters, if not being resolved, could have taken steps to move towards a resolution. I understand that this is the kind of relationship where some things are hard to talk about and there's all these walls, but I felt at a certain point it was an artificial contrivance of narrative that no one ever talks about the issues that would fill us in on what's going on and would also maybe bring us to the resolution the film ultimately gets to faster. So because no one's talking about anything, so nothing can get resolved, a lot of the film, I think, is in a holding pattern where the plot's just kind of spinning its wheels and nothing much is actually happening.
I don't begrudge the film the extreme reticence of multiple characters to not talk about history or what may have happened, especially within the confines of seeing each other immediately for the first time in a little while in a hyper-stressed situation, in a situation where you are concern for your own future and those not only who have care but those who are around you and your immediate family. I can understand how they would not want to tease this out. One element of it is teased out later in the film. We'll get a bit more of an explanation if people who do want to be able to point to it and say, hey, this is the direction it's going. But I think there's enough of a flux in the relationship that I didn't feel it was static. I referred to it. I mentioned earlier the karaoke scene that I actually quite liked. It started off as what for me was going to be the worst scene in the film. I hate when characters use a song to sing about their feelings, but then it actually teased out the dynamic between the three as they all began to sing a lot better. So it could have been a terrible scene, but I feel it was actually a peak of the movie for me.
The thing about this flux you talk about is, to me, it didn't feel like the characters were grounded from a real enough place, or that there was enough actual depth to their relationships or to their dynamic. So it seemed almost superfluous, you know, the kids are shifting to being more oriented towards being sympathetic to the mom. Oh, no, now something annoys them. Like it seemed to basically happen on a whim, as opposed to being well thought through in terms of character progression. And sometimes these turns are actually manipulated by weird artificial things in the narrative, like them running into the kids from The Shining at a pool. The twins, I don't know.
Yeah. None of the ways anyone else in this film acted made too much sense to me.
Okay. Actually, I do have something to say about that scene in the pool, the kids from The Shining, for example.
The kids from The Shining.
At no point in the film did we ever get to understand how this kind of badminton effect that, you know, this shuttlecocking through.
I didn't understand why or how, why it was happening. It was just
What kind of impact can it be having on the actual kids? And there was this one scene with the Shining kids, which demonstrates, especially with the young boy, and how he then reacts. And I think that was one of the few instances which I was genuinely taken aback, and I'm like, okay, now I can see like what kind of impact this kind of perverse game, and it felt like a challenge game after a while, because it was just like, you know, a game of hide and seek, to be honest, essentially. And you never quite understood the ramifications of what these kids were going through, except they had no agency through and through. They were just like, okay, now you're with us, now you're with me, now you're with me, now you're with me.
Yeah, that's what's often like when you're a teenager in divorced families.
However, the film needs to go further than that to be satisfying as a narrative, like either to give some kind of backstory or to really delve into that chaotic psychology in the children in a deeper way than this did. As it was, it just felt kind of half-baked to me.
However, what I liked is that, and we can't really talk about this without spoilers, but in the final act, an issue, a choice, confronts the main character, the likes of which, especially as it pans out, at least as it appears to pan out, we don't often see in film. It's relatively honest, having the sort of issue play out in the movie. It's relatively confronting, and I liked that it was there. This honestly could have been the bulk of the film with me watching her deal with
That would have been much better, because most of the twists and turns in the narrative for me didn't feel like they came from a genuine place. With that in mind, can I talk about the club scene?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so after the daughter runs away, she's on a period of, I don't like you, mom. Yeah. She runs off with some kids and she goes to the club. There's a number of things that are crazy going on here. One, it's every parent's nightmare mood of all the shots of, oh no, the drunk people as the mom
young boys with hooded jackets.
Exactly.
In fairness, there are a lot of dickheads out there with hooded jackets.
Yeah, there are. I agree. There totally are. But at the same time, it felt like it was striking this really sensationalistic, manipulative tone.
It reminded me of the scene of Destroyer.
Right. We go into the club and we get the ultimate sensationalistic manipulative shot where we see the boy's face as he looks up with this kind of confused horror at the topless dancing girls on the poles. Now, this shot didn't have the effect I think it was meant to have on me, because immediately I just thought, would that boy be allowed in the club? I looked it up and no, he wouldn't. You have to be at least 16 to be admitted into clubs in Spain.
Chris is being responsible, and Chris, you're right. Yeah.
That's right, and you're not supposed to think about that, because if you did, you'd realize that the daughter wouldn't be allowed in there either. So it's already on thin ice, but then it turns out the mum arrived just in time to see the, oh no, drugs being sensually pushed into the daughter's mouth by the evil hooded jacket man. She approaches the guy, and it turns out it's a Tic Tac. How many people at a club sensually put Tic Tacs into each other's mouth just in time for their mum to be like, it's drugs? Oh man. It was one of those things where, you know, when you're so annoyed by a scene, it was just like nothing that's going on here makes sense. And it's all ultra manipulative.
I'm glad, Chris, that you brought up the manipulative aspects of the film, because I had a lot of issues as well. And there were some other scenes that were equally manipulative, if not more, than the club scene. There is an aspect about one of the characters, maybe we can speculate whether or not they've actually been physically harmed. And the way the film treats that as...
But to be clear, physically harmed when in the custody of the father.
Yes.
It's a question as to that.
But the question is that the speculation is my problem with it because it's manipulative, because the film plays it up as the point that that may be the case, but that may not be the case entirely. It is actually played up to depict one thing when it could be an entirely different thing another, and that threat is never resolved. In fact, it's deliberately kept hanging is what I have issues with.
And
because
yeah.
It deliberately takes an obtuse angle to it when it actually there's no need for that.
It bothered me too, because first of all, it felt contrived in the ways that the mother discovers this and then she's thinking about using it to advance her case, and then that never goes anywhere. And secondly, because it's such a major thing. This is what I was talking about the film leaving things ambiguous when it's more interesting and it becomes necessary at a certain point to provide interesting answers than to leave everything ambiguous. The idea of physical abuse of the kids is such a major thing that would alter our perception of the narrative, totally. As well as potentially the outcome.
It is an emotionally hard-tugging, manipulative
and
thing to pull. You can't go back from that.
Exactly. It carries huge weight in the narrative, both in terms of, as I was saying, the outcome and in terms of our immediate emotional response as an audience. To throw that up there just to kind of play with our sympathies a bit and play with this idea of ambiguity, but then not resolve it. And not only not resolve it, but just drop it completely from the narrative speaks to, I think, a irresponsible approach to some of these subjects.
I don't think it was dropped completely from the narrative. I think the question as to whether this specific thing happened isn't as strongly brought up again, but the overall question of the children's welfare, whether there are things that they are not conveying, the issue of broadly whether whose custody they are safest in, if either parent at all, remains a consistent theme. I didn't have a problem with not returning explicitly, more of as, and I appreciate whether they be children, anyone in that example, especially children who are in that particular circumstance and in such a vulnerable situation, would not feel necessarily open and willing to articulate or discuss this at all. So that didn't bother me as much.
I want to get back to the irresponsible side of filmmaking and how it looks at mental illness, because I have major issues with that. And I want to address this actually. And I want to phrase this correctly. So it's important that we get this right. I'm happy for films to actually talk about mental health and mental illness. And there have been many films that have done it correctly. But once you go there, the responsibility as a filmmaker to do it right is so heavily sort of invested in you. And the fact that this film is so callous in its approach. I know what the film is trying to do. We get it. You know, the women historically have been seen as hysterical, as crazy because they are emotional and sensitive, whereas men have seemed to be the rational, logical ones. And we get that perspective that the film is the underlying narrative and the tone that the film is trying to push, that the dad is logical and rational and the woman and, you know, the wife and the mother is seen to be the crazy, hysterical one.
And she might not be.
Okay, I want to clarify something.
But the film in doing that actually plays into that binary itself. And I think that is a problem the film has.
I want to clarify something, first of all. It's not just a historical thing. That is a prejudice and stigma that, whether it be in the context of custody debates or else, is constantly thrown at women all over the world, as is, I think, what you're referring to earlier, the idea that women are inherently seen as more emotional and therefore less rational. But I want to be clear as to your point. Are you arguing that that the person in this film does have a mental illness and it's explicitly made clear in that regard and it's depicting it badly? Or are you arguing against the characterization that this person may or may not have a mental illness, which goes to, as what I referred to earlier, as the intended ambiguity of this picture? I want to be clear as to what your criticism is.
I think the intended ambiguity actually goes against the case that the movie is trying to make.
Agreed.
If you're going to try to make that point that women have historically, and as you rightly pointed out, Glenn, even today, are seen like that and it goes against them, then actually state your point, state your politics. And the film pops out from that. And the fact that the ambiguity actually undermines that aspect of the film, and we never get to actually understand the film's politics as clearly as we should.
I agree.
I'm just trying to be clear. Is your point that this is attempting to be that it's a criticism of the film, that it's attempting to be deliberately ambiguous, or that this is actually a depiction of someone with mental illness and then treats that issue poorly?
May I step in with can I paraphrase, and Verrett can tell me if I'm on the wrong track, because sure. I think he and I feel similarly in this regard, and we're about to find out. I feel like running this kind of theme. First of all, as an ambiguous thing, first of all, it plays into the idea that, oh, maybe she is just the crazy hysterical woman, which is counter to the idea of negating those ideas and the feminist undercurrent, because it leaves that possibility open as opposed to stating the case. And secondly, I feel like it's harmful because it feels overtly manipulative to use such sensitive subject matter as a tool to play with the audience's emotions if there's not going to be any deeper resolution where the film states its case. Like, it feels like it's using the specter of horrible, destabilizing mental illness just as a way to ping pong audiences' emotions and create a thriller, as opposed to for a really deeper purpose. There's a point where
it's challenging.
Oh, yeah, yes. There's a point where you need to drop the ambiguity.
Literally, exactly. I think you've hit the nail on the head, Glenn, Chris. I mean, Glenn, my issue is exactly that. I know you're trying to say that where my issue is, whether the ambiguity is.
I'm not trying to say what your issue is. I'm trying to clarify your criticism of this, is that the person actually has a mental illness.
No,
and
it's about
the film is doing it dirty, or the issue is that it's deliberately ambiguous in and of itself, or both.
My issue is that we actually don't know, and that is the problem. I could be very happy to say whether or not that the person did not have a mental illness, but we never find that out. The film is deliberately ambiguous, and that is the problem, because it negates the politics and undermines its own case if that is the route it's going to go. If it is trying to make that point about the undercurrent of mental illness and its impact and treatment of women and how that's basically gone against women historically and even today, then the ambiguity in the narrative of the film actually goes against it, because it's actually playing up the issues that it's trying to negate. Essentially, it's losing its own case in that sense. The clarity in stating your politics in this kind of a movie is, I think, absolutely imperative, because the clearer you are about where you stand in terms of as a filmmaker and where your politics are is exactly what would get your audience on side and make this a more engaging film.
There's nothing to negate the more negative interpretations you could run from this.
So that was Charter.
Verrett is going to leave us now because we're taking a break in the recording and he hasn't had time to catch the next film yet because we got the screener really late. So Verrett, thanks for being part of Film Fight Club for another week. Great to have you back. See you next time.
Yeah. Good luck with Uncharted Territories.
The next film we're talking about is Sea Fever from the Year of Voices of Women in Film section. It is from director Nisa Hardiman and starring Hermione Caulfield, Doug Gray Scott, who people remember from Mission Impossible 2 and other films, was supposed to be Wolverine, and Connie Nelson from Wonder Woman and Gladiator. It is in some respects based on an Irish legend. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. It is set in modern day. It is about a scientist played by Caulfield who goes out on a trawler into the great wide ocean with a crew, and then one day a mysterious creature of unknown origins and scale and power attaches part of itself to the ship, and it goes from there into fantasy, supernatural elements and elements of the surreal with a thriller and some horror elements, I would say. Of the three, I wish we'd covered this with Verrett. Due to the timing of getting the screener of the Christmas.
Didn't have time to watch it. He did not have the time to see it, unfortunately. But I thought it was by far the best of the three films
Absolutely.
That we're covering tonight. This film was, I think, a smarter corrective to a lot of creature features we've seen before. It tries not to be too sensationalistic in comparison to what you expect from this genre and the kind of action or the kind of creature interactions you have. It's meant to be a more grounded sci-fi take. The characters are notably not just head-slappingly stupid as they tend to be in this kind of 10 Little Indians scenario in, you know, creature / horror movies. And the characterization across the board, I thought, was really good. The people were consistently characterized, and they felt like how I imagine real people in this scenario would be. It reminded me of Alien in how they felt like genuine kind of working class people, as opposed to the macho stereotypes that usually fill out those roles in Hollywood representations.
They act in ways I would expect them to, with a couple of exceptions, they're all relatively fleshed out. I think, and this is a minor criticism, they were done a little dirty by the screenplay in that it does fall back on some of the standard horror tropes. There's a character who references family, I wonder what's going to happen. There's a character who wants to have sex, I wonder what's going to happen. But regardless,
the rest of the film is smart enough that I'm not think that I barely thought of that as I was watching it. You know, that it doesn't feel like it's existing in that dumb kind of space, even if it's touching on those hallmarks of the genre. The film is smart enough otherwise for me to think that that's an intentional kind of wink.
Yeah, on the Alien reference, it is set contemporaneously, but it gives enough context for how they ended up in the current predicament, how they cannot access support at the time. And part of that is due to the foolhardy actions of some characters, which I totally believe characters would undertake in this circumstance. I referred earlier to the Irish legend element of it. There's a strong role that superstition plays in this narrative and the functions of many characters. And it's realistic because we're in a world where it's established people could have these sort of preconceptions. But more than that, as in many of these films, there's a rationalist. In this case, there's the scientist, the main character played by Hermione Caulfield, who is always there to be a counter to that. But what I liked about this a lot, and it's a dynamic I can't really recall seeing in many horror films, many films for that matter, where it's the rationalist who has the strongest exposure to the supernatural surreal element first. So the challenge isn't coming from external to, oh no, this is ridiculous. She's the one who immediately is forced to question what she is seeing, what is happening. And that was quite novel for me.
I don't think the film, to be honest, really leans into the supernatural. But there's the allusions to Irish folktales and legends, right? But the creature itself is dealt with using scientific methods and seems to be an explicable scientific phenomena. I might be reading that into the film, but it's not explicitly presented as, or even implied to be presented as a fantastical kind of creature. It's just a creature that we haven't encountered before. Like it, do you know what I mean? Like it has some novel movie-like characteristics, but it seems to be, okay, I'll give it a little more credit to what you're saying, because it does in some ways evoke H.P. Lovecraft, Cthulhu mythos, kind of with that sense of like awe and of the uncanny.
Yeah.
But essentially, I thought her scientific rationalism was used to overcome the threats, whereas the other more superstitious people on board the ship were basically stumped. And so I was confused when right at the end, the film kind of moves into a more metaphorical and mythical kind of conclusion, which I didn't think the mythic undercurrent was strong enough in the rest of the film for that conclusion to feel right. That's one of the few areas where I think the film stepped a foot wrong.
I think that didn't bother me so much because there were a few allusions throughout, whether it be the masthead and the name of the boat, the particular Irish legend they're talking about, which I have some familiarity with. So they didn't tease out too much throughout the film. They presumed a level of knowledge in this regard. I was able to benefit from that grounding, and therefore I liked the end of the film a bit more. I think the majority of the audience won't be an Irish audience and prospectively won't have this sort of backgrounder. So I think it's something they could have teased out a little bit more in order to have the film be that much more resonant. I think that was a detraction in the movie. On the matter of the creature, I'm sorry, I'm tired. I had to
edit. Me too. That's why I had that long pause before.
Your other point was to, the balance they struck. Okay. In terms of the scientific versus mythical treatment of the creature, it strikes a balance that I think is very akin to how a lot of, Chris and I are both big Doctor Who fans, and it has a bit of a Doctor Who tone in that you have a person, a scientist, with a ragtag group of people in the situation they don't know, and people slowly being picked off. It reminds me of a lot of Doctor Who episodes, but particularly, I guarantee you, the writer has seen at least season 4 of Doctor Who, and a particular two episodes is reminding me strongly, the Vash and the Rada, the Darkness in the Library, but there's one episode of season 4, Midnight, where David Tennant goes with a group of people, they're on a ship and they're in some sparkling lake, and a creature they can't see begins to pick them off and make them think and speak in strange ways. And it strikes that tone of, yes, this is real, but this is also of a...
something beyond what we understand.
And I liked that. I liked the balance they struck in this.
I did too.
Methods they used to address this were really interesting and well thought out. And it wasn't just random people coming up with these great ideas. They established that you had a very highly qualified scientist who was there to do a particular job and could infer this.
I thought also that this was a really successful film visually. I think it used its probably limited budget really well, worked to the constraints, and doesn't end up feeling cheap as a result. And I think the creature is visually interesting. There's some interesting scene transitions and blocking. It's well directed visually, which stood out compared to the other films we've spoken about tonight, for sure.
It had a very limited special effects budget, which, like similar to an episode of Doctor Who, I feel it well deployed and then a similar vein. On the matter of its visual resonance, I noted both this and Charter used water symbolically. In Charter, it was very heavy-handed. It means the sense of the unknown and going into the unknown. Here, it also lent it a sense of eeriness, as there's just these great shots of her looking down into the waves, wondering what's beneath the sea, and especially in the relatively isolated plane they were at.
Yeah. You know, you're just reminding me of one more way to take a shot at Charter. Okay, so you're trying to run away with your kids and not get noticed, right? How about going to a holiday destination and hanging out at the resort? That seems like a good idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of...
Anyway.
There's a few problems with that movie. Hey, let's talk about a better film.
And symbolism, when they pull out the parrot and like, oh, it's a bird trapped in a cage. Anyway, you're right. Back to Sea Fever.
It's a better film. Another thing, I don't want to give... This is more contextual than anything else. The film could not have predicted this, but in light of the pandemic in which we find ourselves...
I was thinking about the cliche of the floating Petri dish that we keep hearing about in the media and how this film is essentially about that. It's interesting how close the scenario is to some of the events that have occurred in the last few months and some of the discussions we've been having about how those events maybe should have been handled. But it's also funny to watch it post-COVID because all the people touching their face all the time, which I think is probably an intentional choice by the director to create suspense. But with our current level of knowledge, I feel like the scientist would have said, hey, everyone, stop touching your face, stop touching your eyes.
Yeah, to be clear, a lot of discussion bases around how a parasite... I understand COVID operates distinct from what we see in this film and other parasites, but how a parasite, it is now just some extent, how a parasite can spread through wounds or for touching each other or being close proximity to each other. But there's also a very key discussion about individual versus greater welfare. If we were to go close to land, are we doing a disservice to others? Are we being selfish? To what extent must we isolate ourselves? To what extent do we need to take the burden and sacrifice upon ourselves? To what extent should we not care or have thought for others around us? And that's obviously conversations that very much are playing in the cultural zeitgeist. For very serious reasons right now. So the film did resonate with more, I think, a lot more now than it would have any other time. Curious timing in that regard. In terms of the horror and the gore, there is a bit of it, but it's not
overdone.
Yeah, it's not overdone.
The whole film is way more low-key than you expect when you think, oh, people at sea trapped on a boat with creatures. You know, you expect a gore fest and something way more over the top in terms of scares and shocks, and also in terms of how they deal with the problem. This tries to keep it grounded, and I actually appreciated that because it's tense enough. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the actors were good. Hermione Caulfield.
Actors were all really good.
Things. I haven't seen Doug Gray Scott, but he's played in a long time, but he's playing the old sea captain.
He was really good.
Wisdom. Yeah.
He was really good.
So was Nielsen. She's great in everything. Mm-hmm. One thing that did annoy me, I call it the Bob effect after Stranger Things, where a character, it's such a thing in horror films where just to show you what the creature can do, a character we're not supposed to care about dies in a horrific way. No one reacts or really does anything or pretends to care. And then when a character we're supposed to care about dies or something happens to them, suddenly, oh my God, it's on. Shit just got real. And this happened in this movie. And that really bothered me. I appreciate that the first character we see that isn't someone supposed to identify with or know too much about, but it should have more to impact on the tenor of the conversation, the tone of the film, certainly impact on the character's psyche, especially as this is from the, we see this whole film play out from the perspective of a character who's exposed to this. But it doesn't change tenor at all until it happens to a named character, which is a bit much for me. Less of a stretch than in Stranger Things, where no one cares about Bob, but still, I think a tonal shift that was necessary that wasn't present.
Yeah, I agree.
So that was Sea Fever.
A pretty surprising, refreshing creature feature, a nice updating of old cliches.
I think this is going to play really well with the crowd who like the Cthulhu story.
Yeah. And I wonder if this would have been in the Freak Me Out Strand had there been a full festival instead of Europe Voices of Women in Film.
It probably would have been one of the key features. Because Freak Me Out, I like Freak Me Out. And I see them all every year. A lot of them are, this isn't an aspersion, low budget bottle films which rely on a lot of horror tropes, and they're fun and they're great for midnight viewing. This one actually is quite innovative.
So this is a cut above.
Yeah, this might have led to Freak Me Out section. Could have also played at the Irish Film Festival, or might still.
Yeah.
And yeah, Sea Fever. Check it out. There's a lot of great films coming out of Ireland. And
yeah, they definitely are doing some good investment in new talent over there.
Yeah. So I was at my last night in Ireland. I was in Dublin and I went to the Irish Film Institute. You know what they were playing?
What?
What's the film? It's the Australian, they take clips from lots of other films, pulling
hands. Soda Jerk are the filmmakers.
Yeah, the Soda Jerk compilation.
Terranullius?
Terranullius, that's it.
Right.
Great. Like, I'm here and I see you. It's like The Simpsons. We're in Japan and we go to America Town.
Yeah.
So Sydney Film Festival, huh?
Yeah, another year. And, you know, it's been a weirder year than usual. So here's a weirder SFF than usual. Maybe just smaller SFF than usual. Yeah. We've been having a lot of small nights in. No, not many big days out.
Yeah, but we'll have big days out. Cinemas open July 1st. I'm sure people are going to be going back soon. And let us know what you think of SFF, because there's quite a few good films up there.
Yeah.
And it's going on for a bit. It's a nice thing to watch with friends.
Yeah. Next week, we'll be covering The Assistant and The Five Bloods, two of the biggest new to streaming films of the moment.
Yeah, new films out. Yay.
In the living room.
Yeah, films that could do qualify for this year's Oscars run in the 14th month bracket that they're now in. So the films we cover, just the recap, we're Sea Fever.
It's a 16 month bracket.
Oh, you're
starts
right.
Starts from hard. January.
It's way too much.
Yeah.
Way too much.
Anyway,
have a safe night.
Yeah. Or a safe day. Whenever. Have a safe rest of your days, ideally.
Yeah. Be safe. We'll see the movies incredibly soon.
Take care, guys.
Good night. Bye.